It's the Popmatic Podcast for November 16th, 2016.
The worst episode ever.
Hi, heroes. It's the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Jovial Jeremy, and joining me today are...
Amanda.
Super Sarah.
Marvelous Mike.
Clem Marie with no alliteration.
Bill.
All right. So Congressman John Lewis's marvelous memoir, March, is the Nashville Reads selection for 2016. This terrific tome has folks from Bordeaux to Bell's Bend reading a graphic novel. And the esteemed envoy from Georgia and civil rights hero is speaking this Saturday, November 19th at 10 a.m. at the Martin Luther King Jr. Magnet School, nestled right here in Nashville. He's also the rarefied recipient of Nashville Public Library's Literary Award. So in honor of Congressman Lewis's visit, we, the purveyors of all things Popmatic, are poised to ponder the panels and pages of comic books.
Woo!
So join us on a four-color field trip full of frantic philosophizing and frequent fulminations!
Oh, man.
Wow. Pow!
Amanda.
Yes, Jeremy.
What did you read in honor of this very special episode?
I didn't read anything. Books are dumb.
Okay.
Just kidding.
That's the other half of the story.
I didn't think about that one for a second.
Okay. Marketing burn.
Okay, so for the most part, I don't think that I've really lived that sheltered of a life. And then I come across something like the book I'm going to talk about today, and I realize how naive and basically lucky I have been. So as Jeremy mentioned, U.S. Congressman John Lewis, who currently represents Georgia's 5th District, is Nashville Public Library's 2016 Literary Award winner. He won this for his 2013 graphic novel, March, that tells the story of his life through the turbulent civil rights movement in the 1960s. Jeremy called it a tome. I might argue that. But it is divided into three parts.
I was just doing the alliteration.
Ah, I see.
Correction.
Fancily called Books 1, 2, and 3. And... Lewis, you know, was the author. He was also assisted by his political aide, Andrew Iden, in the writing, and they're illustrated and lettered in black and white by Nate Powell. So Lewis grew up in rural Alabama, which is about 50 miles south of Montgomery. He was always a good student, and he was determined to continue his education after high school, where he eventually moved to Nashville.
Yay, Nashville!
Where he attended American Baptist College and then went on to Fisk University. Mm-hmm. And he became a leader in the local nonviolent sit-in movement at Nashville lunch counters. So March goes into pretty great detail about all the meetings that he attended and the training that he had to undertake in order to become a nonviolent protester. Now, these sit-ins were not something that Lewis and his fellow students undertook lightly. They knew there was a very good chance that they would probably be arrested or beaten or both. Now, for me, I'm not sure that I would have been capable of participating in a protest like they did. I'm pretty sure that I don't have the level of grace and patience needed in order to not fight back or at least mouth off when they're being threatened and spit on and struck. The civil rights movement happened before I was ever born, and it's always just been something that I read about in history textbooks. And one of the biggest reasons that I liked March, especially the first book, was that it gave me a first-person perspective from someone who was really there. It also gave me a different perspective of events from someone who wasn't quite the celebrity that we've always heard about Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks. And he's somebody who's there on the front lines with them, but he hasn't gotten quite all the press that they have. Now, in addition to the Nashville sit-ins, John Lewis was also a freedom writer. He spoke at the 1963 March on Washington, which is the famous I Have a Dream speech from Martin Luther King. He was also one of the leaders of the march from Selma to Montgomery to kind of solidify African-American voting rights. Now, before I read March, I had no idea who John Lewis was. Now I have to admit, I have great respect for the man and what he did to help bring equality to a divided country. I'm glad that I read March. I'm glad that we picked John Lewis as our 2016 award winner. I think that March is one of my favorite of all the award winners that we've picked. And I do also have great respect for Lewis as a man.
Sarah,
you're here. Well said.
I'm not much of a comic book reader. Who am I kidding? I've never read a comic book until recently.
Hey. Jeremy,
Jeremy has corrupted you.
Breathe, Jeremy.
Welcome.
Shame.
You'll get your membership card soon.
Sounds good. I have nothing against comic books. I think they're awesome, and we wouldn't have the eye candy of Chris Hemsworth as Thor without them. He's still my beating heart.
Meow.
And on a side note, I went to go see the movie Doctor Strange last night.
Mm-hmm.
Not knowing.
Weird.
Yeah. Strange coincidence there.
Oh. Very strange.
Yeah.
Doctor Strange coincidence.
Not knowing what to expect at all because I didn't know anything more about the character other than what I'd seen in trailers, I really enjoyed it.
By the hoary host of Haggoth. So did I. I opened my Eye of Agamotto and my Sanctum Sanctorum.
The only thing that could keep me from it is the crimson bands of Sidorak.
Wow.
Sidorak.
Okay.
That
was
Juggernaut. Future correction.
Oh, damn!
Okie dokie.
Yeah, we've deeper into comic books. Wow. Yeah, we took a left turn.
Yep. Anywho.
Well, I'm just going to leave
I
now.
I opened that box, unfortunately.
Whatever.
But anyway.
I lost my card.
Benedict Cumberbatch is fantastic, as usual, and pulls off an impressive American accent. But to get to the comic book I chose to check out, I'm better than some. We'll just say that. I've heard a lot worse.
Future quibble from Mike.
Mike's over there taking massive notes.
I prefer baseball.
Rebuttal.
And American football.
Oh, poor Benedict Cumberbatch.
He's
my eye candy.
He can take it.
He's amazing.
Weird. He's unconventionally handsome, so that's my bag. But continue, please. I want
to
hear.
Thank you. Okay, well, to get to the book I chose, I'll be honest, I selected it because I had no clue what to read and simply looked at the read-alikes for this year's National Reads book, Mart. The Complete Persepolis was one of the first selections among read-alikes and understandably draws a parallel to John Lewis's March. The similarity in this memoir graphic novel slash comic book is that it too is a reflection of a struggle and living through difficult times. I'm sure this comic book slash graphic novel has been discussed before in this podcast since it was written so long ago, but this take is from an unexperienced comic book reader, so take that for what it's worth. Author, I might hurt pronouncing this, but author Marjane Satrapi.
Marjan.
Thank you. Reflects back on her childhood growing up in Iran in both humorous and sometimes heartbreaking ways, as she learns about the Islamic Revolution through the actions of her parents and grandparents. And eventually she learns from her own experience as well. Not having a lot of knowledge about the specifics of the Islamic Revolution, I enjoyed learning a simplified version from the eyes of Marjan as a child. Again, I reiterate that some of the experiences she lives through and reflects on, such as the change in dress for women and when she learns about the social classes and their culture, it is heartbreaking. But the entire story isn't all revolution sadness. There are lighter sides to it as well. Well, really, the lightness exists in the dialogue and how it's not as serious in discussion as I'm sure it was in reality, if that makes any sense. And furthermore, the story continues throughout Marjan's adolescence as she's growing up and learning about herself, but also living through difficult times in which the country that she loves is rapidly struggling and changing. The book was eventually adapted into an animated movie in which Satrapi co-directed the film, and it was nominated as Best Animated Feature at the 2007 Academy Awards.
Good movie.
The library does indeed have the film, the soundtrack, and of course, the book in a variety of formats. The simple comic book is the best example, though, so go with that. It's a good read, not just for the first-time comic book like myself, but also a great way to put yourself in someone else's shoes. My...
Long-time listeners may remember that I used to be the Jeremy of the group and that I used to recommend comic books a lot, so much so that my dad thought I was the comic book correspondent of the show.
Your parents actually listen to the show?
My dad does.
That's so nice.
He's one of our four fans.
I've mentioned the podcast like dozens of times to my mom, and she's like, podcast? What's a podcast? Meanwhile, my sister only listens to Welcome to Night Vale. I'm like, you know, you could, like, you know, try. Nope. I still read comic books, but I've kind of passed on recommending them most of the time since, you know, it was way more of Jeremy's thing. You know, I keep expecting a Kim Gordon memoir comic book to come out any minute now. Then he'll just retire.
Jeremy's having hand cramps.
It's also a Seinfeld reference.
I'll take that. Okay, cool.
And a Bob's Burgers one, but please continue.
Sure. Today I thought I'd recommend two comics I catch in my back pocket for recommendations. So I'll start with one this segment, then one in the next one. Huh? So first, I thought I'd talk about a comic book that speaks to our troubled times. Prez. Prez was originally a comic book from DC that only ran for four issues in the mid-70s about a teenager who becomes president of the United States.
Yeah. Are they still available?
Do we have that?
No, I'm getting to what we actually have. Oh, admit. It was a satire, of course. Much of the joke was about baby boomer culture, because back then, you know, oh, these kids these days. Now it's like, you know.
And the voting age had been lowered.
That's what I'm about to get to.
Sorry.
It also skewers the worship of youth in the media. And, of course, the voting age had just been lowered to 18. according to the interwebs, he also tangled with legless vampires and the great-great-great-great-great-grandnephew of George Washington.
Whoa.
I have to track this down. This sounds amazing. For a long time.
I think he was co-created by Joe Simon, who co-created Captain America.
Wow.
Possible cool. future correction.
Wow.
You have an encyclopedic knowledge of this.
By Captain America's shield. Cap Wolf. For a long time... Prez was best known as a digressive single issue in Neil Gaiman's Sandman series, where if you, like me, know virtually nothing of DC Comics beyond Batman, you'd be like, who is this kid? What a joke. Teenage President. This was a thing? What?
I think,
this
like...
brought to you by 2001, Mike.
I think it seems like all of DC's output in, like, the 60s and 70s was solely created so dudes that had, like, tripped and, like, done drugs in the 80s could, like, them and, like, make them what they were intended to be.
Prez was recently rebooted in 2015 and was collected in a trade paperback written by a guy named Mark Russell. He sounds like the political guy, but anyway. Named Prez, Corndog in Chief.
Wow.
It's set in the distant future of 2036, where you can vote for president using Twitter. And all age voting requirements have been abolished, and corporations can vote.
Oh.
A YouTube video featuring a 19-year-old named Beth Ross having an accident with a corndog machine goes viral. And all the kids find it hilarious and vote her president of the United States.
Oh,
wow.
My God.
This is so scary.
This is not funny.
This is scary.
It's not funny anymore.
This
will
happen. It doesn't sound far-fetched,
really.
No.
No,
corn dog in 2020. I see it.
You can do this. Her first mission as president is to cure a disease that has been ravaging the nation. It goes head-to-head with the corporation that not only created its vaccine, but also the disease itself as a way to boost its quarterly earnings. One of the major characters is an android drone that gains intelligence and joins an LGBTQR support group. See, for robot.
Yeah,
I had a good time. The comic is both funny and wickedly satirical. Supposedly, it's going to continue this year, and I, for one, am looking forward to more stories of a president with tiny hands that I can respect.
This man elect already looks like a corn dog. So.
Did we have that?
We have that.
Corn dog?
Yeah,
cool.
It's amazing.
That's awesome.
Check it out immediately.
Corn dog.
I do like corn dogs.
I said, now I want a corn dog.
I know.
Yeah,
really.
Don't you have that craving?
Yeah. Meat and bread.
I know.
Your favorite.
On a stick.
Whoa. We need another cooking episode.
Don't forget the mustard.
Oh, yes, mustard. Yeah.
That's the only part he can eat.
Yeah. No,
mustard, yes, sir.
I have complicated feelings on mustard.
Mustard is delicious. Well,
we could catch up with that later. What do you have, Marie?
Yes!
I know you relish this kind of stuff, Mike.
Well played. Okay, y'all.
So
today, I did not read a comic book, but I read about a character in comic books. I read today, for this episode, I am talking about The Secret History of Wonder Woman by Jill Lepore. This book, I have recommended to more than one person. And this, if you are looking for a book that is a fantastic, deep archival product of archival research. If you're looking for a book that is history, that is humor, that has things like polyamory, feminism, lie detectors, disgrace academics, and
bondage
and comic book characters, this is the book for you.
Yeah.
So Jill Lepore, who is a professor at Harvard, I actually listened to the audiobook available through Overdrive or Overdrive app.
Same.
And it's a fantastic, she's a fantastic reader of her own work. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, coming from an academic background, most academics aren't sometimes the most engaging narrators. She's an engaging narrator, and she narrates her own work, revealing what were the actual conditions behind the creation of Wonder Woman as a famous comic book character. Now here I would like to have, I am of course now thinking in my mind of the 70s TV show Wonder Woman.
Yeah, I was about to say Wonder Woman
spinning around.
Yeah.
Yes, but
Linda Carter.
Linda Carter, yes, we shall continue.
Yeah, we will.
Me
so,
now.
Yeah, maybe in private later.
Hey, aren't you the guy who was stalking Linda Carter? The term is courting. The restraining order says no, no. But her eyes say yes, yes. Nuff said. Stan Lee insulted me. But in Bizarro World, that means he likes me.
Yes. Wonder Woman is the creation of William Moulton Marston, who was a Harvard graduate in from three different schools, undergrad, law, and PhD. And he was also known as the creator of the lie detector test. But he was deeply influenced by the women of his life and the feminism of the early 20th century, especially, for example, Emmeline Pankhurst, who the famous suffragist. So in the 1920s, so he created Wonder Woman after, you know, a checkered academic career, a checkered law career. After he and his wife, for example, had brought in Olive Byrne, one of his former psychology students, to be part of their polyamorous marriage. So this family, they all live together in a small house up in upstate New York. And the poor discusses in her book how Wonder Woman was very much a creation. William Moulton Marston saw Wonder Woman he saw Wonder Woman as a way to propagate his feminist beliefs, his belief that women should be in charge. But wrapped up in that was a lot of things about, like, bondage, because he was using a lot of the early feminist imagery of women being locked up in chains and breaking forth free from their chains, and, you know, as they mm-hmm. gained the right to vote and they gained more rights. Olive Byrne was also, interesting enough, the niece of Margaret Sanger.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yes. So into the story comes comics, comes bondage, comes polyamory, comes psychology, comes lie detectors, and also, you know, contraception. So this is a fascinating
it's
book.
It's got it all.
It's a fascinating book. Also, the print version is also, the audiobook version, which I listened to, is really worth listening to. It's a really great, enjoyable listen. But the print version is also really important to look at because it has reproductions of a lot of the Wonder Woman cartoons, of papers and pictures from the Moulton Marston estate, has full color representations of cartoons and everything. So if you are looking for an interesting story behind the scenes of the creation of an American icon, the very, very interesting story, please do look at The Secret History of Wonder Woman by Jill Lepore, available in audiobook and in print. So
yeah, sounds wonderful.
Yes. All right. Bill.
Okay. Dick Tracy's first appearance was on Sunday, October 4th, 1931, in the Detroit Mirror. That appearance was followed by another page on October 11th in the same newspaper, and on Monday, October 12th, 1931, the Daily Strip began in the New York Times. Soon after, Dick Tracy became a nationally syndicated series that ran from 1931 to 1977. And also, interesting note, the creator of Dick Tracy was a man by the name of Chester Gould, and he never missed a deadline during that entire time.
Unlike William Moulton Marston, excuse me. He missed a lot of deadlines later on.
Chester Gould was a journeyman newspaper artist who presented the idea of plainclothes Tracy to his editor, but the editor liked the idea but changed the character's name to Dick Tracy. He thought a shorter name would be better. In the early 1930s, there was an emergence of action and suspense comics such as Buck Rogers and Tarzan, for example. In 1931, Gould got the idea for Tracy while working at a newspaper and saw the headlines about gangsters and their escapades. He created a character in which good would triumph over evil. And this brings me to what I want to talk about, the celebrated cases of Dick Tracy, 1931 to 1951, by Chester Gould, as an introduction by mystery writer Ellery Queen. In this book, you get to read the adventures of Dick Tracy and the villains he runs up against. And Dick Tracy had some of the best villains: the Blank, the Mole, BB Eyes, 88 Keys, Flat Top, and Mumbles. It's fun stuff. It also has an interview with Chester Gould in it. So check out the celebrated cases of Dick Tracy by Chester Gould. Also, a couple of years I was at a WonderCon panel, and it was about crime comics, and Ed Brubaker and Darwin Cook was there, and they both agreed that Chester Gould's creation of Dick Tracy was a major influence on them. Jeremy.
But where does Madonna come in?
I was going to ask. Do we even have that in the movie
Breathless
anymore?
Malone.
Yeah, right. I was going to ask because you always do movies.
I liked
if
the
you
movie.
Had a, if you had
I
a,
liked
if
it.
You,
I liked
if
it
you were
time.
Actually going to talk about the movie, the 180 vehicle.
It's it's Breathless Mahoney.
Breathless Mahoney.
Oh,
sorry.
Well.
I guess my
and she's in the book too.
I like that, Dick Tracy. I thought that the movie is like a not a failure, but like a fascinating, almost like the Breathless the musical heart there in the middle is like kind of. But like the aesthetic, the colors and stuff like that. They kept it all like four colors.
Was it the
really
first movie
cool.
where De Niro started to go nuts?
That was Pacino.
Pacino. I'm just king of
wow.
today.
In episode of
Corrections.
Big Boy at the Prairie. Yeah.
I don't look so dumb no more.
Whatever.
Except Mike and I are the only ones keeping score.
just read the book, The Celebration.
Yeah, that's
right. Chester Gould, he's great.
Inglorious, black and white. So, you know, when you're really hungry and you go to the grocery store and you're like, and you want to eat like everything you see from jars of relish to donuts and wheels of cheese. So that
might
was me.
Might pass on the relish, but yeah. On the rest.
Maybe not at the same time.
I don't even like relish, and I was like, well, that was the first thing that came into my mind when I wrote it down. So that was me this week, because I was like, what am I going to talk about? We're specifically doing a show about comics that opens the door for me. I've been reading comic books for 25 years. I remember the first four comic books. My origin story for how I came to read comic books is very clear, and I will tell it to you some other time.
Yeah, this is when people remember I should just cut it and come back 5 minutes later.
So anyway, so what I'm saying
does
is like
it involve corn dogs?
It does not involve corn dogs. It involves
corn dog man.
It somewhat involves like those little spicy sausages that are like in the little
the vacuum pack.
Yeah, vacuum pack, the little red hots or whatever they're called. Funny enough, it does. It was a lonely
it's
summer.
A sausage party.
Yeah.
I was just thinking the same thing.
So anywho, the hours-long quote from Jonathan Lethem that I read a couple weeks ago got me thinking, but he mentioned the gentrification of comics and it sort of got me thinking about that. And since my tastes tend to stay away from the comics gulch, which is capital G gulch for our non-Nashville listeners. What I'm saying is I like as much garbage as I like fancy stuff. I thought I'd talk about a time when comics were totally in the slum of the entertainment industry. And so this is the golden age of comics, ironically enough. So this is roughly the late 1930s to the early 1950s, sort of in the period where Bill was talking about. It's a really fascinating time because prior to all that time, the 20th century and even a little bit before, you have comic strips and newspapers, and they're very popular, and Dick Tracy and stuff. And in the 30s, you got the pulps and people, things like Dick Tracy and The Shadow and Doc Savage and stuff. And so all of that kind of comes to a head when they start packaging these comic strips in magazine form and selling them. And then, boom, it goes boom. So writers and artists and publishers were building this industry from the ground up. So they were kind of doing anything and everything that they could. Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman all came from this time, but they were all still in their infancy then, just a few years old. And little Peter Parker was barely a twinkle in Stan Lee's typewriter or Steve Ditko's inkwell. So you can read about some forgotten Golden Age heroes in editor Greg Sadowski's book, Superman, the First Wave of Comic Book Heroes, 1936 to 1941, which features an introduction by Jonathan Lethem. So, like I was saying, superheroes sort of began as an amalgamation of like circus strongmen and magicians, and then pulp characters like The Shadow and Doc Savage. And then Superman came along and sort of created this surefire template for like, okay, here's what we're going to do, strange visitor from another planet. When he first appeared in 1938. And then soon, publishing companies, fly-by-night dudes and everybody else, were scrambling to kind of create their own money-making superhero. So Superman proves that trying to come up with the next big thing is almost as difficult as coming up with a big thing in the first place. And so that's That's very clear in the creation and then almost immediate disappearance of many of the heroes in this book, like Skyman, the Silver Streak, and Yarko, Master of Magic. But there's a lot of life in these stories. There's a creative abandon that's sort of found only when writers and artists can make up the rules as they go along. And one great thing is they didn't, like writers and creators today, they didn't need to bow to the needs of continuity or perform fan service or concern themselves with maintaining a franchise. No one had anything invested in any of these characters other than the few bucks that they were paying the people to create the stuff. And then, you know, they were selling soap and radio shows and blah, blah, blah. So they were trying to make a buck and just create stories that people would want to read. So some of my favorites from this collection include Basil Wolverton's Space Hawk, Superhuman Enemy of Crime. Wolverton does really weird work. He's really good at grotesque characters. But then there's also the brutally strange work of Fletcher Hanks, and this is probably my favorite in this.
Of Fletcher Hanks.
His work is the epitome of old weird superhero comics. He's a master of sort of throw it at the wall and see what sticks, which is missing from stuff today. And you can see his work on full display in the book I Shall Destroy All the Civilized Planets, which is a collection of work, again, from the late 30s and early 1940s. Here we meet Stardust, the super wizard, whose, quote, vast knowledge of interplanetary science has made him the most remarkable man that ever lived. And with credentials like that, perhaps he should run for president. Fletcher Hanks also created Fantoma, Mystery Woman of the Jungle. So this jungle man, jungle lady character was a popular trope in early comics. But Fletcher Hanks' spin on it was when she got powerful, her face turned into a big skull. And she would, like, tear people's heads off. And, like, bodies would float into the sky.
Holds for Mark.
Yeah, it is amazing, amazing, amazing. And there's nothing, there's no, like, literary pretense or artistic merit, or it is this weird combination of art, people not knowing what they're creating but creating something beautiful, and then also like the commerce side of it is like, well, we're trying to make money and we just happen to be blowing people's minds. So there's lots of collections from Comics Golden Age available here at the library and elsewhere. And for my money, they are always, always, always worth a look. Hey, guys.
Hey, Jeremy.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well, maybe
the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't. But either way,
it's Tickle My Fancy. Amanda?
Okay, so it's almost Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving, we all know, is a time for turkey. So if you do not have enough poultry in your life, then you need pollo! Okay, who in the world is pollo, you ask? Well,
like pollo in Spanish?
Yeah, like pollo is chicken.
I thought chicken in Spanish.
Is it the Spanish version of poño?
Just listen! Okay.
Okay,
well, if you don't know who pollo is, then you need to read one of my new favorite graphic novels.
Uh-oh.
The series is called Chew, and it's written by John Layman, and with art by Rob Guillory. So I kept seeing these books come across my desk in the library alone, and so being the food nerd that I am, I finally decided to read them, and I was not disappointed. So the basic premise of the story is that Tony Chu, C-H-U, is a psibopath, or someone who gets psychic impressions from food, and he works for the FDA. And he solves crimes.
I love how you've gone full in on comic books and you've discovered, like, oh my God, they make comic books specifically for me.
For me. So in the story, there's a virulent outbreak of bird flu. And so all chicken and other poultry have been outlawed throughout the world. But my favorite part of the book is the secret magic chicken known as Pollo. So on one of his adventures, Tony comes across this illegal cockfighting ring where the super chicken has decimated any and all opponents. So the guy he was working for ended up stealing Pollo right under Tony's nose, and then the magnificent Pollo pops up in other places over the course of the series. Like, they'll be fighting a crime somewhere and someone will go, "Where's Pollo?" And then, like, you'll turn the page and it's like this big two-page spread of Pollo fighting Pangloo Cthulhu, or like upside down evil Pollo, or
that sounds like Phineas and Ferb. I don't know. You probably guys haven't.
Yes,
watched
I do know. Yes, yeah, that cartoon.
Yeah.
So
that's awesome.
So it. So eventually, we find out that Pollo was part of a secret government program and only cost roughly $3 trillion to create. So in my best Veruca Salt impression, I told my husband, "I want a Pollo." No. Okay, totally kidding. I'm not a big fan of chicken unless they're trussed up in my cooking pot. So overall, I think the series is really well written. The art isn't really my favorite. It's a little more cartoony than for my taste. There's a lot of big girl boobies all over. Like every female character has like balloons.
Welcome to comic books.
I'm not shocked, but you know, it got tired. So, and I think that Tony's sympathetic gift sounds cool until you realize what he has to do to use it. Parts of it are just downright gross. Like, for example, if there's a dead dog in the middle of the road, he gets to go take a big bite to see what happens. Oh. They find a dead body in the dumpster. Chow time.
Oh, yeah. God.
So I'm really glad I don't have Tony's gift. Plus, the only thing he can eat without side effects is beets, and I'm not a big fan of those either. So I think the library has all the volumes of Chew. We also have a couple hardback Omnivore edition volumes, so try to get those if you can, because they have extra Pollo.
Yum.
Yeah, it's the omnibus, you see.
Es muy bueno. Happy Thanksgiving.
Wow. Pollo. Sounds pretty awesome.
They do spell it wrong. They spell it P-O-Y-O, and I think it's for the gringos in the audience. It's not P-O-L-L-O.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was disappointed by that, I will admit.
Because sometimes for some folks, it's like, what, the double L? It's like,
Yes, yeah, so.
Pollo.
Nice.
Pollo es bueno.
Alrighty. Well, I'm nerding out on my job today, actually. I haven't mentioned much of what I do in archives since joining the podcast crew.
Archives are awesome. Research is awesome.
It is fun. Though I think most of you could figure it out what I do up there. I work with archives, essentially. More specifically, we handle government records and documents and various other items that cross our paths. Some might say boring, but I say awesome. Take a recent gem that came across my desk. A lady brought in some family files from two prominent Nashville families, the McClanahans and the Weekleys. Connected to what? Yes, Ruth McClanahan. Sure, yeah.
She's a friend. Yeah.
Thank you for being a friend.
Well, the families are connected by marriage. The two families have lived in the Nashville area practically since Tennessee became a state in 1796. So while the collection was small and mainly comprised of genealogical documents, it did also include an impressive photo collection. I already blogged about it, this collection, last month, but I wanted to highlight a little more details about the photographs, because we don't have anything else like them in our collection in archives. They include some old photographs of Nashville, dating back to between 1912 and 1916. But the Weekly family appeared to have the means to travel and went to several places around the country, including Washington, D.C., New York City, Mont Eagle, Tennessee, Mammoth Cave before it was established as Mammoth Cave, and so on. And, you know, I figured that one out because the picture said Great Onyx Cave, which apparently became a part of the cave.
Yeah.
And these aren't just any photographs. Clearly the person taking them was talented because despite their age and wear and tear, the photographs, I mean, not the person, they're still very clear.
You've observed very well.
Yeah, just had to clarify that. I've been editing them for a while and managed to find a few that includes buildings or businesses no longer in existence, such as the Singer Building in New York City, which I did when I saw the previews for Fantastic Beasts last night. I saw that they added the Singer Building, so you can see it there. The few of Nashville photographs include the Parthenon, the Capitol, Fifth Avenue North near the Arcade, where several theaters used to exist, including the Alhambra, and also a few shots of the 1916 East Nashville Fire. While there are some I can't identify that I really wish I could, my favorites include the shots of Washington, D.C. just after the end of World War I. I contacted the National Archives in D.C. for help identifying a few, and I got a good response. I think the most priceless photograph we have is of the Veterans Welcome Home Parade that took place on February 26, 1919. I could go on forever about these photographs, but instead I'll recommend you check out my post from last month where I posted several of the photographs from Flickr. Mike?
Recently, Jeremy and I were hanging out off pod at the Great Escape. My only plans were to shoot the poop and enjoy his... Enjoy his glee at finding 49-cent comics to embed in his collection. When lo, what did my eye see but Godzilla in hell? Yeah.
Yeah.
Short time, listeners may recall. May recall me gushing about Godzilla way, way back in the Shocktober 2016 episode. I think that was Tears of Joy. That's right.
I cried tears of joy when laser shot out of his scales, I believe you said.
Back spine. Right. Correction. Sorry. I guess I'm down. See, at the very beginning, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, sees the actual gate of hell from Dante's Inferno, which has the description, abandon all hope, ye who enter here, and then lights it with atomic flame. Godzilla feels hope. Yeah, that's right.
Atomic flame of hope.
Yeah. Like two of your great loves, right? Like Dante's Inferno and Godzilla.
I know, it's like made for me. Every issue, Godzilla descends into another level of hell to shout "Scree-onk" and lay atomic fire on demons, devils, and fakey illusions meant to tempt even the mighty king of the monsters. But he sees through them after he lights them on fire.
Is it like a burn first?
Is it like a sexy Tokyo that like tries to tempt him, like destroy me, Godzilla?
No, but there should be.
Yeah. Godzilla goes back to hell.
So far, at least, this is the best Godzilla I've ever read because, hey, there's no stupid humans in it. Hooray. In fact, there are no words at all other than Scree-onk, which we all know, Godzilla roar. So, and it's short enough not to get repetitive and tiresome. Hooray. 20 stars. Check it out. We have it in the library in trade paperback form.
Who's the artist?
I don't remember. There's different artists every issue.
Okay. I think Brandon Graham, is that one of them? Maybe?
Could be.
Yeah. Anyway.
Check it out and find out. Yeah. 20 holes. Do you have glimmering?
20 holes,
yes.
Really?
No. Oh, I wish.
Thank you, Mike.
Oh, sure.
Today, I want to talk about something that's not in our library, but I believe you can still watch online on PBS. I want to talk about the PBS documentary, Hamilton's America. Yes, while much of the country was in Hamilton mania, I was not. First of all, I enjoy being gleefully out of touch with things that are cool.
Me too.
Yeah.
Join the rest of us.
I don't like musicals.
Yeah.
I think they're asinine. I feel like the father, you know, and that Monty Python bit when I want to sing. No, no. That's who I feel like every time they start singing. However,
what happens to him at the end of the musical.
I feel a giant butt coming down.
However.
I feel like a Sir Mix-a-Lot song.
Yes, there is a
sort of
mislike butt coming down. Okay. But however, you put me in front of a musical, I will get so wrapped up into it and I will love it. I went to see a revival of The Sound of Music at the Belcourt before its renovation. Hmm. I knew the plot line, but I had actually never seen the movie. I got so wrapped up into it, I turned to my friend and asked, oh my God, did they get out when they're hiding from the Nazis? That's how much I was into it. And also,
the hills truly alive?
Yes, they were. And they climbed every mountain and I was crying at the end.
I didn't know there were Nazis in that movie until like 3 years ago. Or
yes, they are Nazis.
I've never seen it.
They are Nazis.
I'm a boy. Yeah, I'm a boy.
So even if you don't like musicals, I like
Sweeney Todd, Little Shop of Horrors, and Mary Poppins.
I do like hip hop, and I'm a hip hop fan. I was really skeptical about a hip hop musical. I'm like, are you trying to make musicals cool? Please stop.
Especially the old white.
Yes. Yeah. However, like, Hamilton's America, the documentary, is what finally got into it, eating me into after the whole Hamilton musical, the whole Hamilton phenomena, after one of my friends have been trying to get me into it for forever. So Hamilton's America, the documentary, follows the creation of the musical like 18 months before it went on Broadway, follows Lin-Manuel Miranda, the show's creator, as he is developing the show and is researching. There's interviews with cast members and everything. And the whole thing is a revelation. One of the things that I love about about the whole Hamilton phenomenon is the fact that if you're familiar with Hamilton, it uses the actors who play the main characters, Hamilton, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all actors of color. I think oftentimes and I've never also cared about the founding fathers. Boring. However, this time around I care. Because this is why I don't care about the founding fathers, because oftentimes they're used as a cudgel to divide people between who is American and who is not. And Lin-Manuel Miranda turns that trope on its head with the musical, because it says, no, this is part of our history too, and particularly Lin-Manuel Miranda being Puerto Rican. I love seeing Puerto Rican genius in full flower. And this is Lin-Manuel Miranda at work. He is a genius, how he turns that story. And no, we are, even though, for example, in the case of Puerto Rico, we are a colony and you remove us from making decisions that affect our very, you know, our own livelihoods, because that's what when you have a colony. Yep. It shows, no, we are a part of the story, and we are here no matter what historical events may tell us. So I am all into the musical now. I listen to the music. I cry at certain points because it's just that moving. But I've watched the documentary twice because it is inspiring, and it shows the whole creative process, and also does not shy away from the fact, yes, these founding fathers did set up this system. But also, you know, they were slaveholders, and people aren't just one part of the story. There's many sides of them. I think that's what the documentary shows. So Hamilton's America, the documentary on PBS, starring the wonderful genius, lovely genius that is Lin-Manuel Miranda, is on PBS streaming online. Go watch it. It's what finally got me into the musical. Mm-hmm. Bill.
Yeah, I heard it was good. It was really good.
It was good.
Tickling My Fancy on Friday and Saturday, November 18th and 19th, at midnight at the Bell Court, they're going to be showing once again The Room. I have yet to see this movie, but I hope to drink enough Diet Coke to stay awake.
Take a nap.
You have to see it. It's, yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
According to the Bell Court website, The Room is hopelessly incompetent, mm-hmm. unintentionally and hilarious. Charms began to spread, and screening started to crop up coast to coast. I did an interview with Danny Perry, author of cult films, and I asked him if he considered it a cult film. You can listen to the interview. He still hadn't seen it, but I hear it's a movie you need to watch with an audience. It is mm-hmm. a true movie-going experience. This is one I have to see.
Yeah, it's like Rocky Horror Picture. Like, bring a box of spoons, because there's parts where you throw spoons at the screen and...
Plastic spoons?
Yes. Okay. There's a weird thing in the movie. I won't ruin it for anybody, but yeah, it's something you have to go experience. I didn't know what it was till I went, and I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
Yes.
So a true cult movie.
Yep. Excellent. Tickling My Fancy this week, I will stay with comic books. I read Tetris, The Games People Play by Box Brown. Box Brown is also the author of the Andre the Giant book that I talked about, I think, back during the summer. That's a really touching, sweet book about Andre the Giant. And this book is very similar. It's warm and loving, but it's kind of the same technique as the Andre the Giant book. It was more historical, a little more removed and journalistic, not as, I think, wrapped up in like the sort of, maybe the game just isn't quite as warm and fuzzy as Andre the Giant was, I guess.
You're but, wrong.
Well, the story of how Tetris was created.
I
want to
hug
really,
the long piece.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Yeah,
I like the one
warm
that's
at night.
Like this.
Exactly.
It's a really fascinating story. It was created by a guy who, a Russian guy who worked for a computer org in the government, and was just like fascinated by puzzles, and he created this thing, and then he gave it to some friends, and then they copied it and gave it to some other people, and it spread around, and then like there was all this weird stuff with licensing and getting it spread around the world, and then so there's like this Cold War element to it too, because this was sort of in the early mid late 80s, and so like Russia was still Russia then, you know, and the
Soviet Union
sorry, blah, blah, blah.
yeah correction in episode
and breath is Mahoney or whatever. Mahoney,
I don't care.
Yeah. So, but there's also I read this book, Console Wars, about the fight between Sega and Nintendo. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff too. But because video games were a huge thing in the early 80s and then almost completely died out, then Nintendo came and then blew open the doors. And so everyone was, you know, getting on board that ship trying to get games made and stuff. And, money is flying around. And there's also like a really bizarre and tragic twist toward the end of the book. I'll save that for you. Box Brown's art is pretty spare and stuff, and there's a lot of just like little geometric Tetris shapes all over the thing. And it is a pretty quick read, but fascinating nonetheless. There's also a new book called The Tetris Effect, which is essentially the same story, but in print.
By Dan Ackerman.
It sounds like a cool book, too.
And
so
the documentary, the...
Oh, yeah, The Ecstasy of Order.
Yeah.
Is about Tetris Masters. Really cool.
It is
really
amazing.
Really good movie.
I thought I was okay at Tetris. Yeah. I was not.
Corrections. I got lots of them. Oh. But I'll see the floor to the
I completely forgot gentlemen and ladies. So never mind.
Oh, cool. Nice.
I think I corrected myself I online great. Last week, but yeah. I said you authors did. When I said narrators, so sure, that sure. was my correction.
All right. Well, your edification, the fall sample from my failed joke was from the song Eat Yourself Fitter from the album Perverted by Language, which is on Hoopla. Also, this comes from Evil Robot. Works about the fall of man relate to the theme of pumpkin spice more than the lead gremlin in Gremlins 2 gives, quote, spicy stock advice over the phone relates to the theme of pumpkin spice. Sure, in my defense.
Sure. He has a pumpkin on his face. It's what counts. My movie's about the fall of the Clamp Corporation.
Wow.
At the hands of the gremlins. I still Excellent. Win.
Okay, fair enough. So on that tip, we're all kind of surprised to see you here, Mike.
Oh, hi.
After that wicked evil robot burn about your hosting skills.
Yeah.
So I hope you
need to listen to that, but once is enough.
I hope your skin is doing okay. Also from Evil Robot, the metadata attached to the audio file for this episode spells spicy with an E as in S-P-I-C-E-Y, but all other instances of the title of the episode lack said E. So
wow, so
I'm glad we didn't miss that.
So Evil Robot is keen but pedantic, but I can't spell.
Thank you.
And, you know, I this is a spelling that I struggle with because I want to put the E in spicy and smoky, and I'm the 1992 Kentucky Central District Spelling Bee champion, and I still want to spell this wrong because it looks lacking something. It's like
it's less spicy.
Yeah,
than
yeah.
Is it like the U in honor?
Well. Hey, man. Color. Anyway, for more information about my past triumphs, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam.
You can subscribe to the Popmatic Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and the RSS, please.
The show was edited by an evil robot.
And next week, there is no next week, so be thankful for that. After that, because it's Thanksgiving, come on. After that, we have an important announcement for our listeners.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
Stay tuned.
Early comic book heroes were not about life as it is, but creations of how a man with a clear understanding of right and wrong and more courage chose to act, even if branded an outlaw. He dispensed a better justice than a pervading legal moral one. He was a moral avenger. He was not like everyone else, not the average, the common, or the ordinary man. He was the exceptional one, the uncommon one, the one doing what others were unwilling to do, regardless of the opposition and consequences to himself. Today's flawed superheroes are superior in physical strength, but common, average, ordinary in mental strength. Rich in superpowers, but bankrupt in reasoning powers. They are perfect in overcoming the flawed supervillains, saving the world, the universe, yet help us to solve their common, ordinary, average personal problems. It is like creating a perfectly physical adult with the reasoning limits of a 6-year-old. Pop, 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 man, hey.